Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to the Farm Report. And I'm your host, as always, Erin Fairbanks, Executive Director of the Heritage Radio Network. And today we are going to be sitting down with a very special friend, an old boss, actually, Stuart Borowski, Union Square's grass man. Stuart, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thank you, Erin. Thanks for having me in.
It's great to have you here. So I'm excited because, I mean, in a lot of ways, you and your business is really at the forefront of the urban farming movement here in New York City.
Yeah, thank you. We actually started farming. I started the farm growing wheatgrass and greens up in Monticello in 1994, but I moved everything down to Brooklyn near Park Slope in 1999.
Nice. So you've been going 1999, that's what, 14, 15?
14 years. Yes.
And people probably, if you're lucky enough to live in the New York area and frequent the Union Square Green Market, you'll recognize Stuart and his stand because you drive the short bus.
Yes. Yes. the little yellow bus on the west side of the market.
Nice. And I know when people think grass, we're out, I mean, I always think weed, but that's not the grass we're talking about today. So why don't you break it down for us? What are the grasses and the sprouts that you produce?
Sure. I'm growing wheatgrass and other sprouts, but they're really grown as microgreens. And the distinction is that they're brought on past the sprouting stage for about 7 to 10 days so that they're actually greens. But because they're so young, they still retain a lot of the nutrition that's found in the seeds or in the sprouting seeds. So those include the carbohydrates and the enzymes and a lot of the other nutrients that we need for actual energy. So people usually associate greens with cleansing, and the greens that we grow definitely do that. But they're also real food.
So the wheatgrass is something I think people are probably most familiar with seeing in health food stores. How do people usually consume it?
Well, generally, it's ground into a juice, and that's because the wheatgrass has a lot of fiber. On the other hand, it could be chewed. I really compare it to sugarcane, which is to say that you could chew it by itself, or you could put it through a special machine. You wouldn't really mix it necessarily with other vegetables.
And wheatgrass is one of those items. It has a, you know, not shelf kind of stable, so to speak. It's not like a apple or an orange where we can pick it and put it aside on the house. It's a living product pretty much up to the time that you consume it.
Yeah, that's correct. Basically, the nature of the plant dictates the rhythm of our business. And because you want to consume the wheatgrass when it's young, it's got a very brief shelf life as a living plant because it's not going to die necessarily, but it's certainly not going to be as fresh or as tender. Also, once you process it and make it into a juice, the components of wheatgrass juice that are healthy for us include enzymes which actually help the wheatgrass to be digested in your body. And because this is kind of like a self-digesting food, it works even better in your body, but doesn't really sit even in the fridge, won't keep.
I remember from working on the stand, you know, people coming up and kind of, you know, almost a little bit like you were like sometimes wearing this hat of like Dr. Grassman. Oh, I'm having this issue, or I'm feeling this way, or, you know, can the grass help me with this? Can you talk about some of the kind of common correct and maybe incorrect perceptions about when to enjoy wheatgrass and how to make it part of your diet and what kind of impact you can expect to see from it?
Sure. Basically, there's been a tremendous amount of marketing for wheatgrass, partially because it's such a unique kind of food, and partially because people really struggle over the course of their lifetimes, if not, you know, all the time with health concerns, and they're always eager to find some solution, either to repair or to prevent disease. And the truth is that a healthy lifestyle includes exercise, rest, and good nutrition. And so wheatgrass is really a very important part of good nutrition. Now, of course, people can live their whole lives without wheatgrass, but they really should not, in my opinion, live their whole lives without fresh greens, without live foods, and without basically some sort of mixed diet. We get all kinds of what I call food orthodoxies coming into the farmer's market. And of course, across the aisle from me, there's a man who sells raw meat, and people will go up and be like, oh, wow, raw meat. So obviously, everybody, there's a broad range of opinion about what's best. But I really believe that wheatgrass is not only excellent in keeping your body fed, but also regulating your body. It's got a lot of these micronutrients that you don't always get out of processed foods or out of foods that are grown to a shelf-stable point.
So one of the other things that I think is nice about wheatgrass, I think especially for people who maybe aren't really that interested in incorporating a great volume of vegetables or fruits, is that you can get a pretty decent dose in a very small amount. I mean, you serve the wheatgrass in what it's like the juice is an ounce, 2 ounce, 3 ounce portions.
Exactly. Yeah. Generally speaking, people order between 1 and 4 ounces. And of course, I've seen people drink more, and it's really not a problem. On the other hand, it would take about a half a pound of wheatgrass, harvested wheatgrass, to make a 5 ounce cup. So one of the reasons that the juice is so healthy for you is that it's very concentrated. There's actually quite a bit. Now, this is really the ratio of most root and leafy vegetables. You'll get about 10 fluid ounces per dry pound. On the other hand, since wheatgrass is so much more potent as a food in general, it's plenty in a little cup.
Well, I want to get back to kind of the production end of things. Can you kind of take us through the life cycle of the wheatgrass?
Sure. We get pallets of seeds. These are organic hard red wheat seeds, and they're shipped to us, and then we will plant them while they're still dry. We'll plant them on top of a tray of soil or sometimes into containers, because we have people buy containers for their pets. And then these containers or flats are placed into a temperature-controlled room that's also got a misting system. So basically on a timer, every 3 hours the room is misted, and this allows the plants to germinate, to sprout, and then to grow. And because the room is artificially lit, they grow straight up. So it's a clean and regulated approach to growing something that would naturally be found in the springtime only.
And is that the kind of, I'm assuming that's probably the most common way to produce wheatgrass. I mean, I wouldn't probably go to like a wheatgrass farm out in the middle of the country where they would have like open fields of wheatgrass. Would you see that would be used for a similar application, or is it primarily kind of more of a greenhouse product?
I think any time that you encounter wheatgrass, either as a living plant or as a fresh juice, it's going to be grown in the fashion that I grow it. There are people who make chlorophyll, like freeze-dried chlorophyll mixtures, and those are generally from field-grown grasses, and those would be harvested and processed in the springtime. And of course, that generates a shelf-stable product, but you lose quite a bit of the nutrition in that process.
So what happens if, you know, you were just to kind of let the grass keep growing, essentially?
Oh, it would tassel out and turn to wheat. And when I was upstate, one of the benefits of being in the country is that you could actually do that. Now, of course, it takes acres and acres to generate a large quantity of seed, so we never really were able to generate our own seed, but we definitely grew the wheat out both to try to generate our own variety, and also just we sold it as a decorative thing. You'll see them in flower markets.
And how did you get into the grass game in general? I mean, why was that the thing that you stumbled into for your business?
Well, I got started as a farmer when I went to California. I started working on a peach farm, and that was a real eye-opener for me. Up until then, I'm a city boy. I grew up in Flushing, and we had like little tomatoes in the garden, but I never really understood how rewarding it can be to produce your own food. And, of course, in my opinion, there's no better place to experience that than California. Everything grows like magic. So coming back east, I decided that I wanted to be a farmer, and I ended up going to the Union Square Farmers Market to find employment, and I ended up working on a fish farm, actually, up in Forestburg, New York, and from there ended up transitioning to working for a wheatgrass producer, and then I kind of put that all together. Wheatgrass has the advantage, as far as farms go, of only requiring a very small space and a small quantity of money. So I was able to get my business started in the basement of the farmhouse I was living in.
Wow. And getting into the green market, I mean, you've been there for almost 15 years now. What was the landscape like 15 years ago? I mean, I know when you go to Union Square Market now, it's like this kind of thriving behemoth that seems to be like kind of ever growing and full all the time. I mean, was it like that 15 years ago? Were there other producers who were doing anything similar to yours? How was that kind of entry process?
Well, basically, the green market started at Union Square in 1977, and my first year there was in the spring of 95. And by the time I arrived at the green market, I was very much the new kid, and there were quite a few old-timers and even some original farmers. The market itself is similar. I would say that it's the proliferation of small and niche and home processed foods that have really changed the character of green market as people's tastes for local produce and local food products have increased. There's been more and more home processing and more small batch processing. So now we have beer, we have a lot more wine, we have a lot of different kinds of cheeses. And I would just say in general, the demand for product has driven a proliferation of value adding. But the apple guys who are there are still there, and
nice.
And the potato guys as well.
So it was interesting. We were at the Slow Food New York put on a slow spirits event last night, looking at small scale regional distilleries, and some Grow NYC reps were there talking about the regional grain production and the regional grain product. Now, because you're using a hard wheat, is that something that you could at some point in the future or even now source regionally? Or is the variety that you're working with, is it important that it comes from a particular place in the country or the world?
Well, it's, of course, I don't have universal knowledge of the grains that are out there.
What? Wait a minute.
That may be the only time I ever say something like that. But yeah, essentially, we've generally been forced to rely on wheat from a drier climate than the East Coast. So we both from an ethical point of view and also from a real business point of view, we need to use organic seeds. So when wheat is harvested in a moist environment, it can get fungus spores on it, and I just I have used several different varieties of East Coast wheat because hard red wheat is produced probably all over the country, and at the same time I've had the best success because of my chemical-free process. I've had the best success with wheat that's sourced from the West.
Interesting. Well, I would be curious, you know, to kind of catch up with you in a couple of years and see if the kind of East Coast production is able to kind of join there. Or,
well, one of the advantages to getting wheat from the East Coast would be that it would be a tremendous savings in shipping. So I'm certainly excited to try and to test grow and to work with any grower that's interested in trying out those kind of varieties.
And can you, well, that was one of the things we were talking about a lot last night, is the importance of having a kind of diversity of outlets for the regional grain movement. You know, there's bread and spirits and beer and the wheatgrass production like you do. Can you give us a sense of scale of like how much seed are you going through, or, you know, for folks who maybe are like myself, not super familiar, like, what's the translation from, you know, pound of seed to pound of wheatgrass, or and like, what is your kind of, you know, what's an average kind of production volume for you?
Well, essentially, you can get approximately one bushel of wheat, which, if I'm not mistaken, is a little bit more than a 50-pound bag, out of like 2.5 or 3 acres. Now, production methods vary. If you grow everything by hand, like you do on a small farm, you'll get much more yield. But from a machine, from machine-run farm, you know, you're getting between 20 and 25 pounds of wheat per acre. We go through 2 pallets or 2.5 pallets a year, and a pallet is a 50-pound bag. So, you know, we're supporting, you know, 400 or 500 acres of grain production. And of course, the more wheatgrass we sell, the more, you know, the more farmland we support.
That's fascinating. We are going to take a quick break. Before we do, I want to give a quick shout out to Joseph Bywater, who I did meet at the event last night, longtime listener of the Farm Report, who was so lovely to come and say hello. It was really nice to meet him. Hang tight. We are here in the studio with Stuart Borowski, the Union Square Grass Man, and we'll be back for more Grass Talk.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You are listening to The Dream by Cookies. Keep it locked here on heritageradionetwork.org.
We are back after that mellow break song. Thank you for that, Dedrick and Eddie, out there doing the engineering for the show today. We are in studio with Union Square's Grass Man, talking grass. If you want to find out more about Stuart and his business, definitely make sure to check out the website, www.unionsquaregrassman.com. Folks can find you at the market at Union Square Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We're actually just about to take our yearly break, so I'm going to be able to get out of work starting next Thursday. Wednesday will be our last day, and then I'll return August 21st.
Awesome. So I was wondering about that because it's been such a kind of steamy, rainy summer. I mean, because you're producing in a temperature-controlled environment, do you still have kind of the impacts of the weather, or are you able to kind of escape most of that?
Well, both. We are able to escape most of that. Everything inside is not only indoors, but also air-conditioned, and the rooms are plastic and concrete, so it's able to keep them clean. On the other hand, the air quality itself is still impacted by the regional weather, and of course, everything that goes to market, we don't have a refrigerated truck. So to a certain extent, the wheatgrass grows better in the winter and the spring than it will in the summer. And that's why we schedule our break for July through August, because I find it's when a lot of our regular customers are away. And also it gives me the opportunity to dry out everything, clean it up, and prepare for, you know, for Labor Day.
Well, it sounds like maybe you're doing quite a bit of work during your vacation.
Yeah, it's a farmer vacation, yes.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about the grass, but you guys also have a lovely kind of, and I think kind of rotating selection of salad greens and other sprouts. Can you talk to us a little bit about the other stuff that you're growing?
Yeah, basically we are growing pea shoots, sunflower greens, buckwheat greens, radish sprouts, and we've been experimenting with some other fast-growing greens. These all share the same characteristics of wheatgrass in that they all grow very rapidly. They all have a lot of the nutrition that you would get out of the seed and out of the sprout, but they're definitely they're more tender, and so they're a much more flexible kind of food item. You know, you could put them onto sandwiches. You can use them in a saute. You could definitely make great salads out of them. We're very proud to supply a lot of the restaurants that come to the Union Square Farmers Market to source for their menus. We supply ABC Kitchen and Jiva Mukti and actually quite a few. I'm going blank on
No, I know. I feel like I always remember the ABC Kitchen from when I was working, because they would come and just buy so many flats.
Yeah, no, God bless them. They're really all of the restaurants that patronize the farmers at Union Square Farmers Market are really putting their money where their mouth is, because these people are supporting local agriculture in a way that not only provides direct benefit, but also inspires the customers. When they find out that we've been selling to Daniel or to Hugh Kitchen, then they're like, wow, if those guys who are, you know, world-class chefs know what's good, then we're going to patronize this guy as well.
Nice. So I'm curious, you know, one of the challenges in particular for produce purveyors at the market is, you know, you want to show up with enough to make your tables look, you know, full and bountiful. And you kind of want to leave the market with your table more or less as empty as possible. Now, because your products are essentially alive until you serve them, you have, I think, a little bit more flexibility than maybe someone who's cutting, you know, lettuces or carrot. Well, maybe not carrots, but some of the more perishable items. What happens if you kind of grow too much, or it's a really slow week at the market, or it's rainy? What's kind of the end game for a product that you're just kind of not able to move through for whatever reason?
We have a number of farmers at the market that we've kind of partnered with to dispose of all the greens that are either unsaleable or just extra. Very often we're left with greens that are still really fresh at the end of the day, but they're not going to be as fresh the next market, and we already have new greens that we've planted 10 days before. So Lynn Haven goat cheese, she takes the grass for her ducks and chickens, and we supply Fantastic Gardens with many of the cut down flats. He uses them for compost, and there's a number of other farmers who take it as well.
One of the other areas that was new to me when I was working the stand was the grass for pets. I feel like I always have this conversation with like my dog or cat owning friends. I'm like, grass, is it good for dogs and cats? Is it bad for dogs and cats? But then, you know, there you are at the stand, and it's like a real treat for animals. So can you talk about what type of animals eat the grass, and like how do we serve our like canine or feline friends?
I guess forks on the left. Yes.
Oh, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, so something like that. Most people with pets have indoor pets, and because the pets are indoors, they're given a proper diet of processed food, but they usually don't have access to greens. Greens are extremely important for herbivores, of course, because they're the main food source for most, rodents and birds and a whole kind of basically anything that eats plants is going to want greens. But carnivores, cats and dogs specifically, also need greens. They need them as a digestive aid. They need them for minerals, and they basically enjoy eating them as well. I think it really gives a cat and a dog the sense that they're outside on some level. I know that a small quantity of pet grass is sufficient efficient for a cat, but many of our customers will buy huge quantities just so the cats can kind of like lay in it or play with it. So essentially, it's an enjoyable treat for the pets that also help them to get rid of hairballs and get rid of the other things in their diet that they can't digest.
And so you're seeing, you know, we were talking a little bit in the break that this kind of the pet food and the pet feeding aspect of your business is growing a little bit in this, just in this last year or over the summer. Catch us up a bit.
Well, essentially what's occurred over my time at Union Square has been a slow but steady exodus of local residential customers. We still have a great loyal customer base, but many of them have moved out of the Union Square neighborhood just because of the way real estate works. And over 20 years, it's not surprising that the neighborhood would change. We're lucky that it's been more and more upscale. And quite a few of our customers moved to the area that we produce in, to the Park Slope area. And so last year I decided to try to reach out to those customers and to their neighbors who have pets. Very, very often they're not able to come into the city. If they don't work in town, they're not going to be able to come to Union Square. And I feel that we have a unique product in that the cat grass and the wheatgrass that we grow is basically of a much higher quality and much fresher than the stuff that you can find in the large chain pet stores. So we've started a website. It's called High Rise Pet Supplies, and you can order online and we'll bring it to you. I have a really cool Worksman tricycle which I pedal around delivering the grass.
I kind of imagine you with like a bell, like, come get your grass, you know, bring out your pets. Here we are. Well, one of the challenges I know for farmers kind of in general, urban or rural, is, you know, land access and kind of stability with regards to the property that they're farming on, and making sure that if they're investing in improvements in the space, that they're going to be able to reap the long-term benefits of that investment. And I'm wondering, for your business, Are you leasing? Do you own your space? Does that kind of factor into your business at all? Have you always been in the same space in the city?
Yes. Yeah. We moved down to Brooklyn, as I said, in '99, and I was very fortunate to meet my landlord, and he's just a really easy person to work with, which is a blessing, because that's the thing with real estate, is that things change and you need a lot of money or you gotta change with them. On the other hand, one of the things that I would be excited to do would be to get some outdoor space of my own, both so that I could produce other things that people want, and finally so that I could process the compost on my own, because even though I'm happy to supply these other farmers with it, the truth is that we would have a great use for it as well. But yeah, basically land issues are difficult, and also really it's always a huge portion of a farmer's business plan.
Yeah, no, I would say, I'd be curious, I'm totally losing my train of thought here. Let me skip ahead. So as, you know, as someone who's been a long term and a long time, you know, standard at the Green Market, I want to just pick, I want to move off topic just a touch and pick your brain a little bit, about, the best kind of like on the sly, under the radar lunches, snacks from other vendors or other people in the Union Square area, because I know that I'm sure over the years you've had to scramble many a times for a bite in between, you know, queues at the stand. And if there was anywhere in particular you wanted to direct people to, or things that might, you know, I don't want to blow up your top secret spots, but maybe if there's like,
I mean, I'll totally answer your question, but it's definitely not my best top secret spot. You can always find those places, New Yorkers know, by looking for the line of quiet, furtive individuals. So, definitely the fish purveyors have smoked fish, and many of the bakers have still warm bread and basically smoked fish and cheese and some of my sunflower sprouts on a semolina bread. That really does it. Yeah, in the wintertime when we set up and it's extremely cold, sometimes I'll actually set up a little camp stove in the bus and then we'll cook something, and that's really awesome too. But yeah, basically there's like there's got to be 12 falafel places around. And it was really Rainbow Falafel will always be my favorite because they were totally there, I don't know, since the dawn of time. But Rafiki's cart is on the corner over on the north side. And he cut me a break and refused to take my tip because he was like, no, we're brothers. We work together. We are brothers. So I really think you can't go wrong patronizing any one of those guys.
Awesome. That's great. Well, thanks for sharing, Stuart, and thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
So as I said before, if you want to find out more, definitely check out the website, www.unionsquaregrassman.com. And if you're interested in the pet supply, that is
highrisepetsupplies.com, and you can go there directly, or if you check out our market website, there's a link there as well.
Awesome. And then obviously if you're in the New York area, in the Union Square area in particular, you can find him slinging, turning and burning the juice machine. I definitely worked up a good right hand bicep with the winter I spent making juice with you.
You make a mean single.
So Stuart is there Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stay tuned next week. We've got the guys from Runa Tea in, kind of talking tea. So looking forward to that. And up next, after a short break, we have the Grow NYC market update. So stay tuned for that. This, like all 30 of the Heritage Radio Network's weekly programs, is available for free. Visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. You can find our programs on iTunes, through Stitcher Smart Radio. We are a membership-supported organization, so we hope you'll consider clicking that Donate tab. Become a member today. We'd love to send out one of our new totes. And in the meantime, keep tuning in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.